So here we are then, the documentary film movement, and the image you can actually see on screen is one of the founding fathers, as generally acknowledged, of what we now take to be documentary. We were spending time in seminars, obviously beginning to explain and look at and overview some of the construction techniques of documentary and some of the ways in which the whole message is given form. But as is often the case with these areas, we do need to look and explore a little bit more deeply in terms of the motivations and the ideas that the actual documentarians actually had and the filmmakers actually had when they were coming up with the concept of documentary in the first place. It's always worthwhile whenever you're writing an essay to actually define your terms, to say what do we mean by certain key areas. And again, we're exploring this whole notion of documentary to the full, both in seminars and this particular lecture. So that phrase that I've put up there, the documentary film movement, what does it refer to? How does it relate to reporting, continuity and change? Well, primarily it refers to a group of filmmakers and also a body of film that actually appeared from the 1920s to the early 1950s. Although, as we've seen, certainly the notion of documentaries still exists with us today, with documentary channels, with a whole range of programming scheduling time being given to this whole notion of what documentaries happen to be, whether they be wildlife, whether they be action-adventure, whatever genre you choose to actually select, there's usually a documentary that's working through the process. But the first one, as indeed you may have recalled I was talking about last week, but again it works through that, was that particular one, slide taken from the documentary entitled Nanook of the North. This was produced in 1922, and it primarily was looking to reveal the notion of Eskimo life in the northern reaches of Canada. It really provided this whole new possibility for the medium of cinema, which up until 1922 had primarily been used to outline cinematic fictions. Although there were a number of cases of reality being represented on screen, indeed in the early days of the cinema, Nickelodeon, many patrons were warned that the trains that they were seeing coming towards them weren't real. It was the virtual reality sense of what they were seeing, how they were seeing, and so on. This was a significant step in terms of documentary, because the maker, Robert Flaherty, primarily wanted to record and document what he saw as the life of the indigenous American native who lived in the north. And there's a photograph of Flaherty and his family. And let's talk a little bit about his backdrop. One of the quotes that Robert Flaherty has actually come up with, which again I think maybe focuses on why he was so interested in the documentary as a cinematic form, is as follows. Even in my youth, I was always exploring new country. My father was a mining engineer, and in manner of speaking, we were a nomad family. We moved from one gold mining camp to another in various parts of Canada. I was then about 12 years of age. I learnt to track and hunt rabbits from the Indians, and I had an Indian dog team and toboggan. It was frontier country, where the Indians were much more primitive than they are now. So we're seeing a young man who's growing up very much in the latter days of what we now refer to as the Wild West. That new frontier, the gold rush, the aspects of moving from parts of Western America onwards in search of, obviously, gold, riches, all sorts of other areas. Civilization, of course, is encroaching, and the ways of the Native American are changing. And Flaherty, not only from a nostalgic point of view in terms of what he'd experienced as a young migrant in terms of the Americas, he wanted to capture and provide some sort of record so that we wouldn't reach the stage 100 years from now in the 2017, 2016 period where we think we don't even remember these people. This was a case of documenting their existence. Somehow, in some way, ensuring that the Eskimo and accompanying folk actually still had a message to say to us across the ages. And this is one of the ways in which, using the cinematic aspect, moving images, you can record those kind of areas, those kind of aspect experiences, and begin to develop the whole notion of what we see when we relate to other human beings. It's fair to say that Flaherty himself was an idealist, inevitably. He had this idea of the nobility of man, the nobility of man living the traditional life, living the traditional life close to nature, not actually sort of surrounded by the comforts of contemporary living, by the standards of the early 20th century, with electricity, gas lamps, running water, heat, and so on and so forth, but actually having to make do with the land in the way traditionally that occurred over the centuries. But even in 1922, you couldn't simply get a film crew and camera together for free. You had to fund the film. You had to make some way of actually generating some sort of income. Not surprising, this is the standard line which goes throughout reporting continuity and change. It doesn't matter what the medium is, you still need to actually fund somehow the making of it, or the printing of it, or the production of it. And the film itself was actually paid for by a French company who dealt in fur trapping. Now, we've already got a slight ideological element here, insofar as if you are a company whose speciality in your business is trapping fur, then clearly are you necessarily going to be showing a particularly positive image of the animals themselves? Probably not. You know, so you've got an ideological line that's already going to be taken by the filmmakers and so on. Nevertheless, the film was produced. It still is available. You can download it. It's restored in digital format. You can still see Nanook of the North. And one of the reasons why we keep coming back to it, possibly one of the reasons for its iconographic nature, was not only the fact that it was the first one of its kind, but it also carried with it that kind of connotation that even if you've never heard of the movie or the documentary itself, you're still, the phrase Nanook of the North suggests very cold, Arctic, wintry conditions. One of the people who was influenced very heavily by Robert Flaherty's work was John Grierson, who you can actually see on the right-hand side of that particular image there. Not sure who's on the left-hand side, it's never been quite identified. But he was somebody who was very much a key proponent of using documentary to start outlining and providing images of what he saw again as the British way of life. Also of the way of life of people who were working in Britain at all levels of society. And also focusing on some of those key elements, whether you were a coal miner, whether you were a Scottish fisherman, whether you were a person working in the post office. Again, ordinary jobs being documented for posterity. Grierson was pivotal in developing documentary in the United Kingdom. Let's consider some of his background. Let's consider some of the key things that form his backdrop. Talked about Flaherty, let's look at Grierson now. Grierson was born in 1898. So a little under 120 years ago. He was born in Scotland. He was a university student who was obviously reasonably well educated, and he also fought in the First World War as a minesweeper. Where did he actually go to university? And this is quite pivotal. He went to university in the United States, and he actually studied the psychology of public opinion. This is essentially propaganda, okay? It's a national science. It's a science that really evolved with the social sciences in the 20th century to start, beginning to start explaining why human beings in various societies behave the way they do. How do we actually change the behavior of large groups of human beings? How do we keep this notion of society from falling into anarchy and people doing their own notions? Also, from a particularly capitalist ideology, how do we sell them things that they might not even want in the first place? So again, we're looking at advertising and a variety of other elements that come through within this. So Grierson was beginning to soak up these ideas and take them from the notion of what propaganda actually operates, how public opinion is working, how those kind of mass sciences are beginning to sort of present the notion of the class system. Engels had written about this in the 19th century, but clearly Marx singularly responsible in the latter part of the 19th century for one of the major sort of schisms in terms of the global situation in the 20th century. And clearly, in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, there was a Russian Revolution, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics was identified and formed, a whole range of issues working through that process. How do we actually relate to this Calvinistic upbringing, and what was the idealistic notion that Grierson was bringing to the fore here? Well, it was actually very similar to some of those radical press movements that we actually had in the 19th century. The same kind of aspects were being raised and developed from that point of view. Grierson was very much arguing against a background of severe social crises. Poverty and recession certainly manifested in Britain in the aftermath of the First World War and reached a climax in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a huge migration of Highlanders and Irish folk to the Scottish cities, which primarily had developed into what could best be described most kindly as urban slums in the period from 1870 to 1930. It was generally agreed that actually Britain had, in Scotland at least, the worst housing conditions in Europe. Disease, alcoholism, illegitimacy, all were standard business as usual as far as experiencing life was concerned. And the expenditure from the government on the poor was the lowest. Maybe particularly interesting in a week where Canada has effectively agreed to actually give a living wage to those most poor in society. Fairly drastic sort of step. Who knows what we're going to see developing from that point of view. So what do these things lead to? Well, put bluntly, they lead to class conflict. The haves and the have-nots. Unbridled capitalism, a gross misuse of resources to amass huge private fortunes, and primarily one in which the exploitation of the workers, in which the majority were subject to huge deprivation, was the standard practice, the modus operandi. And yet, why didn't anybody protest? Why didn't we have a British Revolution to complain about these kind of issues? Certainly Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin had kind of had a revolution in Russia against the Tsarist government. What was the situation in Britain? Why was this the case? A number of theories have come forward, one of which was that we'd already had two civil wars in our history, so we'd sorted out our kind of urban angst. But perhaps more specifically, there are four key areas that need to be considered for this area, all of which serve as a backdrop to the documentary filmmaker's passion for revealing the truth and celebrating the ordinary. First of all, the labour movement at the time was dominated by respectable, moderately skilled workers who were primarily opposed to radicalism. They believed in the status quo. Place of a working man was to stay with other working class people and not to have ideas above their station. There wasn't a great deal of class movement because, frankly, why should we actually argue with a situation that's always worked? Okay, times are tough, but we can actually see things through it and so on. Secondly, the Scottish Labour movement was also dominated by the pro-capitalist Liberal Party at the time. So again, in Scotland at least, you're seeing a general sense of deference to the conditions to be maintained and kept as per normal. Thirdly, the unskilled Scottish workers were primarily impoverished, disorganised, and they were fragmented. Best way to rule, divide and conquer. If you split people apart into different sort of areas, then they're less likely to unite against you. And fourthly, there was a rather interesting ideology which was developing, which was that of everybody should be free to pursue individual happiness. Again, almost taken, lifted from the American dream, if you like. That the free market should be able to occupy itself without any state intervention, that ultimately people got what they deserve, and in essence, everybody would find a natural level. So, in essence, there's no need to actually have any structures in place to support folk, because ultimately, we all end up where we're meant to be. This is one of the reasons why, between the wars in Britain, the overall documentary film movement became associated with the political left. It was seen as a left-wing ideology that was being developed to actually start addressing these key issues, these areas that were being developed. There was a specific and explicit statement in terms of the aims of the early filmmakers like Grierson, like Jennings, like Harrison and so on, that they wanted to provide some sort of voice to the underrepresented working class. This was going to either be by an intentional use of working class people on camera, speaking to camera and so on, or as a byproduct of being a reaction to what was generally seen as a rather stuffy middle-class British film industry. Certainly the notion of documentary filmmakers having much in common with the product of Hollywood was remote, other than both were using moving images to actually tell their points. But documentarians wanted to focus on reality, aspects of reality, rather than focusing on the more dream factory elements that were coming through. The documentary movement itself established itself under John Grierson in two consecutive government film units that you can see there: the General Post Office, which was in existence from 1933 to 1939, and the Crown Film Unit. Both, in essence, actually worked under this premise of working for the government in terms of producing public service broadcasts, public service films, public service posters, again, addressing sort of images in terms of how people would actually get a cheap and hot meal easily, the onset of fish and chips being developed within that whole system. And obviously, in the advent of the 1939 to 1945 period, providing the whole notion of the Crown Film Unit, which would essentially produce propaganda. It would focus in terms of what we were seeing in propaganda and making sure that a positive image was maintained and that messages from the government to the population were, if not as upbeat as the newsreels, still effectively sort of addressing issues in a way that would be taken seriously. But before that, we also have a number of key areas that were developed in terms of some of the other zones that Grierson will talk about. And I'll come to these images in a few seconds. But it's worth noting that what happened in the aftermath of the Second World War was that the documentary filmmakers went on to produce public information films for a number of corporations, including Shell, British Gas, the BBC, and other blue chip companies. One of the key elements which is at the heart of documentary filmmaking is this question of celebrating the ordinary, a line and a phrase I've used several times in terms of what people were intending to do. It's clearly, from our perspective, that we can see the documentary filmmakers as being part of an idealistic campaign for political reform. The film that we are seeing, that we see, that we view, it reflects the writing, it reflects the speeches, it reflects the lectures, and a whole set of attitudes about creating a better society. Writers such as H.G. Wells in Things to Come, J.B. Priestley, and other sort of people who kind of felt somehow we can improve the overall lot of everybody. Not just from a utilitarian perspective, maximum amount of good for the maximum number of people, but from a genuine line of progress as far as society develops. Ultimately, as we've said, John Grierson was an idealist. He came himself from a comfortable middle-class home. He was the son of a teacher, he was well-read, he was well-behaved, and as we said, he was university educated, albeit obviously getting his ideas from the United States. But his beliefs were pretty much summed up in the following aspects. First of all, Grierson believed that the state should always intervene for the greater good. It should prevent individuals threatening the community with selfish desires. So again, taking the line against misuse, abuse of factory workers and so on. Also, Grierson believed very strongly in the goals of society. The notion that each individual should develop to his or her full potential. That social duty was an essential part of the whole aspect. That society in general, in order to exist in any form of harmony, needed to be a unity based on the general good of all. Again, remember what's actually happening at this time. Things such as the Jarrow Hunger March and so on are very much at the fore here in terms of some of the challenges that we're faced with. Some might say not too different from the present day. Now, it may well be that what Grierson is advocating here is ultimately rather naive. H.G. Wells has often gone on record, or was gone on record, as being shocked that his views of an elite society run primarily by scientists or philosophers and so on, indirectly, was being mirrored in Nazi Germany with the so-called superior Aryan race being put forward as a way of ensuring that things were sorted out. And inevitably, ideas that you develop at university sometimes don't evolve in your later lives to fit your experience or fit your reality of how life could be, or how life should be, or how life is. Also, technology, which is developing all the time, and that medium of communication from state and corporations to the people, sometimes it can be used to advance social cohesion, but inevitably, even if you have educational and social aims, people might not be interested. They might actually just want to be entertained. They don't want the educational and informative elements. Grierson himself actually wrote as follows: "I have no great interest in films as such. I look on cinema as a pulpit and use it as a propagandist." So he was quite blatant insofar as he wasn't interested in entertaining people. He wanted to get a message across to say, this is what conditions are like, this is what people are doing, isn't it good, isn't it bad, and so on. You're being invited as the audience to read and decode structures that were actually there. The films themselves, as we look at them, and Drifters being, again, an early version of that, it's obviously shot 7 years, or at least 7 years, after Nanook of the North, they were collaborative productions. They were technically quite innovative. They used montage, they used combinations of shots, they used a shape and a form of cinematic literacy that regular cinema goers would have been familiar with from the perspective of the point of view of the characters, what was being looked at, how things were being developed, and so on. And a broad range of approaches were actually taken to the structure of the films themselves. You would have poetry introduced, you would have realism, you would have montage, and you'd also, where appropriate, actually have surrealism that would be developed within that whole field. But fundamentally, the key aim of all of Grierson's works, and indeed his contemporaries, was to show people working together for the social good. That's ultimately the big message that's coming through with this. No matter how hard the work might be, whether it's Alberto Cavalcanti talking about the nobility of the coal mine, or the fishing industry and so on, you're getting a whole range of people working collectively for the common good. As I mentioned last week, Grierson and his supporters were completely against the content of newsreels. They looked at newsreels as dumbing down cheerful rubbish that wouldn't offend or worry anyone. And you might agree or disagree, having looked at some of the newsreels since last week and so on. But what the documentary makers are very clear is that they're determined to make people think in the way that the filmmakers want them to think. There should always be a dominant, preferred reading that we actually see here. A message which, above all else, is the way that you decode the images or the film that you're actually seeing. Critically, you can argue that the version of social good might not be everyone's choice. You could even argue that because most of the documentary filmmakers were middle class, upper middle class, reasonably well educated, actually had access to funds to actually make the material in the first place, to have the equipment and so on, that actually they were elitist, they were out of touch, you know, they weren't hugely popular. You know, in terms of availability, yes, but if you were asked which one would you go and see, Abel Gance's Napoleon, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, or indeed sort of latterly the whole notion of the jazz thing, etc., or Drifters, I don't think Drifters would be on many people's lists of things to go and see. So they weren't hugely popular. But it is quite fascinating if you watch documentary filmmakers in the archive sequence, because the technological tricks and techniques that are still used, fade-ins, fade-outs, dissolves, German reverse shots, a whole range of other aspects are still in use in filmmaking today, and there's still techniques that are being used today. Everything, as we said, from cutaways to structures and waves format. The continuity, if you like, continues from that point of view. And Drifters itself was a montage that was set on the Scottish herring industry. However, although ostensibly shot at sea, which actually focuses on the tremendous excitement of this celebration of the ordinary, there was a slight issue with respect to the whole sequence, because the interior shots were all shot in a film studio. So whilst the viewer is entitled to actually see, oh, this is all taking place in sea, etc., oh, underwater footage and so on, no, the underwater footage was actually an aquarium in Plymouth, a research centre, which basically, if you actually look closely, you probably not be able to see it, you can see the reflections of the glass as well in terms of the sequence. So although the view and the aim and the objective was to produce a documentary showing the real life of the Scottish herring industry, what you're seeing in practice is no different from any filmmaker's techniques who are effectively using shortcuts or technological shortcuts to cope with the fact that actually you couldn't have actually put a film crew on a Scottish herring boat and expected to get any useful, worthwhile footage. You know, we're about 60 or 70 years away from the kind of reduction in size of cameras that enable you to get shots and individual shots of such clarity and so on. Alberto Cavalcanti, who was a fellow documentary filmmaker, studied architecture in France and became involved in avant-garde filmmaking. Filmmaking which effectively was designed to disturb people. That's Cavalcanti on the left there, with a coal miner out of hand. But it was basically designed to really make people think about what it is they're seeing. Back in the early 1920s and 1924, the surrealist film movement had actually developed with the likes of Salvador Dali, Auguste Buñuel, talking about Un Chien Andalou, trying to destroy narrative in terms of producing just a montage of images, apparently completely disconnected. Everything from an eyeball being sliced open to ants in a hand and so on, through nuns dragging goats slapped onto a grand piano. All of which make no sense whatsoever, and yet they never quite succeeded. You could argue that what we see is the contemporary equivalent of the early surrealist filmmakers is manifest in the music videos. These sort of online things, some of which have narratives, some of which don't, but again still sort of echo in terms of the images that we actually see. And Cavalcanti was very much focused on the whole notion of not only working with Grierson throughout the 1930s, but he also played quite a significant role in many of Grierson's best films, as they're referred to today. What Cavalcanti actually brought to the table was an understanding of film techniques, and also the way in which you can actually generate early special effects that would actually sort of serve as a way of enhancing the short story, enhancing the narrative. Does that destroy the truthfulness? Does it actually take away from the notion of what people are looking for in, as a couple of seminar groups already discussed, this amorphous notion of public trust? Again, it's to be discussed and debated. Humphrey Jennings, who I've already mentioned, worked very extensively with Tom Harrison and others in the Mass Observation Project in Bolton in the 1930s, was also very much a believer in the form of real documentary filmmaking. And this particular sequence is taken from Jennings actually producing some basic propaganda, which was called Listen to Britain, in which ostensibly we're invited as the audience to take the point of view of the ordinary, plucky, working-class Brit who's battling through against those ruddy Germans and their nightly blitz bombings and all the rest of its abuses. And where's he screening those films? He's screening them in Washington, in New York, all over the States. It's a way of generally generating the notion of saying, look, we need to have some help, some impact. Now, arguably, you could say, well, actually, no difference whatsoever, because after Pearl Harbor, it was kind of a done deal that effectively America would get involved in the Second World War. Or you could say that it had paved the way. It had opened, it had kind of at least nudged public opinion to actually become engaged in the conflict on the side of the Allied forces rather than simply producing an isolation of viewpoint and not taking part at all. It's difficult to really assess how effective Jennings was in terms of developing that structure, but nevertheless the techniques that he's using in terms of images like Listen to Britain was very much focusing on that. And that recreation of a British culture comes through in the after-war period in Basil Wright's Song of Ceylon. This at a period of time where India is just about to declare its independence from Britain, step away from its sort of part of the empire and so on. But Basil Wright in this particular documentary is focusing on the effect of modernity and industry on traditional ways of life. You could argue that Song of Ceylon in the late 1940s wasn't too different from what Flaherty was actually doing in 1922, 20 or so years earlier, with respect to the traditional way of life of the Eskimo. Again, a filmic documentation, representation of a day which is beginning to pass, which is fading into posterity. Not forgetting, of course, the notion of ensuring that the ordinary is still being celebrated, that housing problems and issues related to that are also worth discussing and being raised. Again, if you can't raise these things onto the agenda by using film, what is it for? If you can't raise these things by printing them, doing stories, why is it sort of in existence? What is the purpose? How are you looking to do an effect change by putting these things into action and so on? And if you're looking at things like housing problems, this was again quite a novel technique, though it might not seem so from that initial shot there. But what the documentary filmmakers liked to do was to have the dwellers, the authentic citizens, the working class people, talking directly to you on camera. Now, even today, the only people who talk directly to you on camera, face on, are newsreaders and the Queen. It's a very, otherwise you're on a slight angle, you're a slight tilt, you've gone through this in terms of the basic thing, there is a way forward. If you're being addressed directly, ostensibly from a psychological study, it means you've got much more chance of making direct contact with your audience and getting them to start thinking about what it is you're talking about. And whether you're talking about, again, problems from the outside or indeed in the inside, it's addressing these kind of areas. It's still a technique that's actually used within documentaries to engage empathy, to generate sort of the notion of saying something must be done at a whole range of levels. Even arguably things such as the charity thons of children in need and so on, comic relief, sports relief, etc., still use these kind of notions of beginning to draw on people's empathy and sympathy and so on with Eva. So what else were the documentary filmmakers also looking to develop, etc.? Well, I said earlier about that phrase, celebration of the ordinary. And this particular area also demonstrates on one hand both the kind of resonance that it provides and how they use a range of techniques to get their point across, but also that celebration of the ordinary. This is from a Humphrey Jennings aspect called Nightmail. And what we see in the opening sequences, and you can again download this, look at it at YouTube, etc., but you have a montage of shots of the Royal Mail delivering its rail overnight, which is taken from the viewer's perspective with a number of shots apparently taking place on the train itself. Answer, no, that didn't take place on that train. That was actually a studio set. But it also had a soundtrack. It had a voiceover from the poetry of W.H. Auden. This is the night mail crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order, letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop on the corner, and the girl next door. So again, a whole range of sort of elements coming through from that, all designed to sort of promote this sort of notion of, oh, this is what's a documentary. This used to be screened fairly regularly, even on British television, as a sort of filler, well up until the 1970s, late 1970s, before it effectively sort of was retired to the archives and so on. And it's called Night Train. It's about, say, 10 minutes long, but again, it's working through that whole process. And how is that being developed? Well, again, the argument is that this whole notion of public service filmmaking has been developed as a range of social documents. What we're seeing with Night Train and its comparison scenarios, whether you're Humphrey Jennings actually doing anti-war, or rather, shall we say, anti-German propaganda, having to start fires, because obviously you can't actually get the film crew and the documentary film crew out to see the buildings as they're basically sort of being set alight by the German bombs. So you have to, again, creative license, set the fire itself. Set the fires in action because the ends justify the means. Now, what is the difference then between what we're seeing here with Humphrey Jennings starting fires and what W.T. Stead was doing with the Maiden's Tribute and Eliza Jennings and so on? I don't know, to be honest. And again, there's a whole range of issues that you can take if you had a comparison between what the decisions were being made in terms of how they were developing and so on. Big question to consider. Are documentary films representing reality then, or are they trying to create it? Inevitably, as we've seen going from the fishing industry documentaries through Nanook of the North onwards, documentary is always going to be artificial. It's always going to be a recreation of reality. It's inevitable. It can't be otherwise. People are going to be aware of the camera. Even if they're speaking to the camera, you're still aware that camera is actually there. And so you've got this element of manufactured elements, which are really at the heart of documentaries in the same way as they were at the heart of newsreels. As we've said, British documentary films also had and have a political dimension, inevitably stressed further by the outbreak of the Second World War, and many directors such as Jennings would turn their attention to overtly propagandist film. And again, you can look at the propagandist films online fairly regularly. You know, the messages are coming across in terms of what we're seeing, how we're seeing, and what sort of message we as the audience are expected to take from those areas. I've already said in terms of Humphrey Jennings' work, fires were actually started. And some of those political ideas that also infused the work of the documentary filmmakers also enthused newspaper and magazine photographers, such as the Picture Post, a really popular magazine that existed for about 20 years, from the 1930s to the 1950s. It was influenced very heavily by the US magazine Life magazine, and really gave an opportunity for photographers to capture candid images of life in the mid-20th century and beyond. Again, this celebration of the ordinary and the notion that there was a tendency to focus on the nobility and the richness of ordinary life. Ordinary people, ordinary folk in Blackpool reading My Reply to Goebbels and so on. But again, this sort of snapshot of reality. Social cohesion, reinforcing that notion, seeing what's being developed, etc. Probably both of those characters, the panda and the child, are now dead. But that's by the by. In terms of the sequence, you've still got this whole notion of social realism. What is being seen? Social entertainment. How things are being presented. How things are being packaged. And as we saw last week with the newsreels, finally, both notions not only impacted in terms of newsreels, but also documentaries, which were in essence driven out of business because of the realism that television could actually bring with it. And the sort of line that television in itself can open up a whole new field. We've also said that the public information film was another key offshoot of the sort of elements that we're seeing. And the idea, ultimately, that film was a good way for the government to communicate with the public for the public good. There were lots of campaigns that were actually used and a part of this, which you can access on YouTube today. Coughs and sneezes spread diseases. Even climate change in 2005, also sort of mentioned in terms of ways in which the documentary works and functions and so on. Central Office of Information itself was a very rich employer of the documentary filmmakers. They produced a wide range of information campaigns. They were designed to inform the public on a huge range of issues, which again affected their daily lives. Things relating to health, things relating to welfare, things relating to education and rights. So arguably, all those ideological views that the documentary filmmakers like Grierson wanted to see put in action and put into action actually were being echoed in the latter part of the 20th century and emerging. We're actually up to pretty much the 75th anniversary of the Central Office of Information's work. And that celebration of work that also carried out a whole range of groundbreaking projects that helped to shape attitudes. Attitudes relating to the way public conduct could be changed, as well as how citizens could be provided with important information. But at the same time, whether we're looking at public information films, Charlie and his cat basically looking after road safety, etc., right the way through to police scenarios and so on, all of those kind of areas still raise the philosophical questions and the psychological questions of, are the filmmakers, when they're working within documentaries, whether they are short documentaries, whether they are public information films, or whether indeed they're versions of Planet Earth, are they trying to alter behaviour? And if so, with what success are they actually trying to alter behaviour and so on? The National Archive of Public Information Films is a good way forward, but I also want to just conclude by just looking a little bit at some of the sort of notions to wrap up of another sequence which I take you way back to what is arguably the first documentary scenarios, and that's Daniel Defoe's tour of the through the whole island of Great Britain, 1724, 1725, and 1727, illustrated with a set of H. Moles maps of the counties of England in two volumes. That goes back to, again, a celebration of what we are in terms of Britishness and so on. That, in terms of the 20th century, J.B. Priestley's English Journey, a Jubilee edition with 80 period photographs, starts beginning to again reveal the 20th century way of recording change and so on, which also ties in with the notion of Brandt's work of the English at home, the class system, the ideologies, and ultimately that echo of Nanook of the North in terms of Flaherty's work, again preserving a way of life that maybe actually we're better without, maybe we want to go back to, or maybe I say we're still living in. Thanks for your time, and make sure you've signed the register, and I'll see some of you again in seminars.